Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really amazing founder, you know, a founder that has done it multiple times, very successfully so. And again, we're going to be talking about the building, the scaling, the financing, all of the good stuff that we like to hear. So again, you know, brace yourself for a very inspiring episode. And without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Sergio Fogel. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So originally born in Uruguay, you know, how was life growing up over there? Give us a walk through memory lane.
It was quite different, the Uruguay back then than the Uruguay now. There was almost no technology scene. But what was very particular about Uruguay is a very deep tradition of lots of mostly theoretical mathematical education. It's a system, educational system, quite based on the French one, where relatively few people got a very high level of education in math, quite deep. Other than that, Uruguay was always a very boring place where nothing happens. It changed a lot recently, but yeah, back then it was not an ideal place for a teenager to be living at, where you're looking for adventure and excitement.
Talking about excitement, what got you excited about computers?
Actually, it's a Sinclair Spectrum. I don't know if you remember, there used to be a very tiny computer called the Sinclair. Sinclair was the name of the inventor. He passed away not very long ago. And I once was traveling and visited London, and a friend whom I had met showed me that computer, and it just blew my mind open. I couldn't believe it. And I said, I must have one of those. I essentially took all the money that I had spared in that trip. I spent all my money on that machine, brought it home, and never looked back. I really became super excited, and I had to learn more and more. So I started to learn how to program in BASIC and then assembly. And then I started to learn about the processor. It used to have a Zilog processor. So I got very, very deep into that.
So then in this case, how do you find yourself in Israel? You know, that's a long way from Uruguay.
Yeah, well, I'm Jewish. I had to learn the Hebrew at school. And as I told you, Uruguay was very boring at the time. I was 19 years old. I was studying at the university. We had just transitioned from military dictatorship to democracy. But the whole system was a big mess here in Uruguay. So I said, okay, I have to leave. And I went to Israel, got accepted at the Technion, which is the Israeli version of the MIT. And for me, I absolutely loved the hardware and software and stuff. And it was like going to Disney World. And did very well over there. Studied computer science, then did a master's. Again, I like to go very deep in everything that they do. So I ended up being a researcher in computer science, and I loved.
So then let's talk about there being in Israel, you know, because you were there for quite a bit of time, you know, and that was ultimately the place where you started to do your first, you know, steps in the business world. So how was that for you?
Yeah, well, actually, my first steps in Israel were more in R&D. At the Technion during my master's, I was quite deep into computer science, and I went into a VLSI design, a chip design. As I told you, I like to go deep, but it was super exciting. That place used to work for IBM in the Haifa Research, used to be the research center, then became research lab. Amazing group of people that from all over the world, very, very smart people, learned a lot and absolutely loved it. I would have said I was very happy over there. By then, after 10 years over there, we had our first son. And, you know, being Latinos, we want to stay close to the family. Our parents, mine and my wife, so were in Uruguay, and we wanted the kids to grow near their family. So we decided it was time to head back home.
And obviously, heading back home also got you into thinking that maybe it was time to go back to school, and in this case, business school. So I guess coming from kind of like that tech background, what do you think opened up going to INSEAD for you?
Yeah, I went to INSEAD to do my MBA. Also, great experience. I knew that I needed to move out of deep tech because there weren't any opportunities back then in Uruguay. So for me, business school was a step to change direction. Someone, the manager of the career office at INSEAD said that most people who do an MBA do it either to change function, to change industry, or to change geography. And she said, try to keep it just one of them, maybe two, not the three of them. And I said, okay, maybe I'm trying to do too much because I was trying to change all three. So I decided to try to stick to the technology industry, but change geography and change function. But again, INSEAD opened my mind to the whole world of business and many things that, being a computer scientist, I consider to be like almost a treason, like a commercial and the strategy and so on. I found that I actually liked it. And they moved initially, when I went back to Uruguay, I moved to Oracle, to the commercial function, which again, it was in a way a betrayal for an initial part. But then I found I absolutely loved it. And coming from technology, you get such a high level of credibility when you're talking to the IT manager of a company and you're trying to sell a database. It used to be very expensive. It still is. So at the end of the day, people, when they buy, they're buying credibility mostly. And I had that because of my background. So it helped me a lot. Both the MBA and my previous technology experience was super helpful.
So after about 7 years of being at Oracle, you decide that it's the time to start your first venture. And as they say, you either succeed or you learn. So what was that for you? What was that lesson?
First of all, I learned many things. First thing that I learned is do not start a company in partnership with your spouse. And second thing I learned is try not to do it with your own money, even though you feel that you have enough money to fund it. Do not do it. And the third big lesson is that things that look very easy from inside a corporation, when you're outside, are not as easy as they look. So you carry a business card that says, I'm a sales executive at Oracle, and people will take your calls. When you're a founder, it's not so easy. So those three lessons were very, very important. Again, I learned the hard way. I also learned about, especially in the world of B2B, the value of relationships and trust. And that, I mean, I've started a few companies, most of them in the B2B space. I think that all of them, I had the first customer lined up before I even launched the company. And that's super important, super helpful.
So then obviously, you know, after this experience, then you started UniHotel, which actually is still up and running. And this was voice over IP. So how was that, you know, next chapter? Like, what did you do differently to make sure that it was more of a, you know, success experience versus a lesson learned?
Yeah, first of all, in my second venture, my co-founder, we are still partners and we are still very close friends. He's way older than I am. He's 11 years older than I am. And I found that combination to be extremely, extremely valuable because he brought a lot of experience. He knew stuff, the importance of keeping, of managing accounting, of being on top of cash. He brought lots of relationships, and I brought all the youth and the eagerness to succeed and putting lots of hours, learning about the technology. We got into voice over IP. I learned everything about the technology. So you have that combination of experience on one side, the energy on the other, one side brings a relationship, the other one brings a knowledge of technology. And it worked great. And it also worked out very well for me in the following startups when we later started AstroPay. My co-founder, he's 13 years younger than I am. And again, that combination worked out very well for me. So it's something I haven't seen it in any business book or anything of the sort, but I highly recommend it. Typically, the founders are, I don't know, two former classmates or co-workers. That combination, it's harder to find your right co-founder with a big age gap, but it's very, very valuable.
Yeah, because it's also like a mentor, no? Now, in this case for you, the third one was Jet Numbers, and you ended up closing it about 3 years ago. So what was the lesson, you know, that you took away from Jet Numbers with you?
Yeah, it was, in a way, a spin-off from Uniotel. We wanted to do something. We had the opportunity to buy wholesale phone numbers, and then you could buy from us a phone number anywhere in the world and take the call wherever you were. So today, that sounds quite trivial. Back then, it was very innovative. So we had the customers, I don't know, software companies that wanted to have a customer support number in a different market, or I don't know, people who wanted to have a phone number, migrants to give their mothers a phone number that they could call locally or whatever. And it was a B2C company, and we learned a lot about how to manage everything. We were very early on into Google AdWords. And we started selling all over the world. We learned a lot about how to manage. There wasn't yet all the something that's very common today about how to measure customer acquisition cost, lifetime value, estimated lifetime value, how much you can spend on advertising, and so on. So we had to study about that and develop our own tools, which again, today it's fairly standard. We learned a lot about the importance of going after markets that other competitors are not looking at. When we launched, very quickly after we launched, we had a major case of chargebacks, fraud essentially. So people were buying our numbers with stolen credit cards, and then they were using the numbers to do further fraud. So that was very big threat to us. So our initial reaction, the jerk reaction, because most of those transactions came from Africa, our initial reaction was to block everything coming from Africa. But then as that market became more competitive, we saw that we have a real demand coming from Africa and from Southeast Asia. And we saw that those were underserved markets. So at one point we said, okay, let's tackle those again. Let's use other payment methods, alternative to credit cards, and let's not close those markets down. And then we started to focus on those markets. And because those markets are overlooked by many of the competitors, you can make much more money over there. And that's a lesson that we learned that we kept for the long time. And that's how we ended up, I don't know, today with dLocal, we specialize in emerging markets, which are ignored or not necessarily ignored, but neglected by other players because they are so hard also. It's a complete different dynamic. And the other thing that we learned a lot about was how to fight fraud. There's a lot of fraud. Fraudsters in countries like Brazil are amazingly creative. So you need to develop a very, very sophisticated tools, much more sophisticated than what you'll need for Europe or the US. So yeah, we learned a lot.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out. One thing here that I want to ask you is, this was the segue into ultimately AstroPay. And out of AstroPay, you know, there was a spinoff for like what you were talking about, which is dLocal, which is arguably your biggest success to date. I mean, at one point it was valued at $18 billion, the company, you know, which went public. So how did the sequence of events happen for you to get going to AstroPay and then all of a sudden dLocal, you know, starts to become this smashing success?
Yeah, as I told you before, it's when it's a B2B company, it's so helpful to start with a customer that needs a product and tells you, if you build this, I will buy it. And we had the situation initially with a customer, two customers. One of them was PokerStars, and they said, we are having a real trouble in Brazil. If you guys can build a payment solution for us in Brazil, we will be your customer. So we started with that, and we expanded to other. We found a solution, a compliance solution with all the regulations in Brazil and so on. And we started working for them, and we expanded then to other, initially to other customers, what we call merchants in the industry. And then we expanded to other geographies. And what, at one point we said, okay, maybe it's time to split this company in two. High one that this deals with the high risk customers, and the other one doesn't do any high risk. And the low risk part is dLocal. So it's been quite a long journey. It's hard for me to summarize it, but there were a few key milestones. A big milestone was when we got our first investor. We were looking for investors rather than investment, because we became, essentially, we were bootstrapped and we became profitable very quickly because of what I just said, that we had an initial customer before we even have had the product. But it was very important for us to have the investor that would bring value to us. So the first investor was a company called Azar Capital Ventures. So Azar Capital, the owner of that family office is Eduardo Azar. He's still with us. He's the chairman of dLocal today. And him, with his team, they helped us improve the company, do a lot of what our current CEO calls company building stuff, from properly manage your accounting to getting to being licensed in all the relevant geographies and so on. And the other big milestone, again, that we were looking for an investor rather than the investment, and this was after dLocal was a spinoff, was when we got General Atlantic on board, which again, when they did the due diligence on the company, they found many things they didn't like. So we said, okay, we will commit to fixing all this in 6 months. We worked super hard to do that. But again, we had to raise the bar in terms of how we manage processes internally, how we do things that, as a founder, I find super boring, like, I don't know, internal audits or all type of process-oriented things as opposed to customer-oriented things. We're always very technology-oriented and very customer-oriented. But as you grow, you need to have processes in place, and because otherwise the whole house falls. So those are the foundations on top of which you can build more and more customers and products and services. And the third big milestone, of course, was going public. We went public in June 2020. Incredible amount of work. The CEO of the company at that time was already Sebastian, who managed the company up until 1 year ago. Very, very bright person, very driven, amazing leader. And him, together with Jaco, was our COO and team, they did an amazing process. We saw the opportunity to go. We did that in record time. It took us a little bit more than 6 months. Incredible amount of work. We got, first of all, we needed to change auditors because we were audited by our, it wasn't a big four. So, and the auditors demanded to redo the three financial statements. They wouldn't rely on the previous auditors. We had to change jurisdiction. We had to change accounting standards from IFRS to US GAAP. And on top of the normal process of an IPO, which is a lot of work. So yeah, we ended up going public in 2021 at a very high valuation. At the peak, our valuation was 20% of Uruguay's GDP. So it was a very, very big milestone for the country. I mean, we were in the newspaper, in the cover of all newspapers. So we became celebrities overnight, which is something that we weren't looking for and we weren't ready for either. So,
What do you think allowed for that to happen? What do you think were the key ingredients for such a smashing, you know, success to come to fruition?
Well, the company is an amazing company. Andres and myself initially, but most of the credit goes to the rest of the team, to led by Jaco and Seba. We managed to build a company that solved a real pain for our customers. So maybe I should pause over here and tell a bit about what is it that we do. We process payments for the biggest companies in the world, for the biggest internet companies in the world, in emerging markets. So today it's very easy to process a payment in the US or in Europe. Just accept credit cards, maybe PayPal and one or more wallets, and that's it. When you have whatever, let's say a ride-sharing platform or a streaming or an ad network, and you want to accept payments from customers in Brazil or in Mexico or in Nigeria, it's a completely different game. Most people do not have credit cards. The ones who do have credit cards, probably they're not branded with the same Visa, MasterCard, or Amex. If you go to Nigeria today, many people have credit cards, but they are Verve. It's not part of the big credit card schemes. You go to Brazil. Back then, people wanted to pay with Boleto. Today, it's Pix. You go to Mexico, then there's a different payment method. So when you have a big company and they want to accept payment in all those markets, they need to set up a local entity because these schemes do not accept international merchants. So you need to set up a local entity, which means that you need to have a local board of directors and you need to have accountants and lawyers and stuff. It's very, very painful. So we came to them and we said, we'll solve for you Brazil, but not only Brazil, we'll solve also Mexico, and we'll give you South Africa, and we'll give you India, and we'll give you Pakistan, and so on. So there's a huge value added over there. And that allows us to charge, of course, higher fees than what's charged by a credit card transaction. So again, we create a lot of value. There's another thing I like to say is that in most cases, if you are a payment processor and for some reason a transaction fails, the consumer will end up buying anyway. They will either, the transaction will be routed through some other gateway or acquirer, or the consumer will take out another credit card and use the other credit card or whatever. When we fail a transaction, most probably the transaction will not take place at all. So that means, I don't know, a customer who cannot pay for their satellite internet and will stay without internet, or someone who will not be able to take a ride, or will not be able to pay for his whatever streaming services or whatever. So that shows how much value we're creating, and that's what makes me most proud.
So how have you been able to really, you know, work on several projects at the same time? No, I see that also you have Datanomic, you know, in parallel too. So how do you go about thinking about, you know, working in several projects at the same time? How does that work?
Well, it's It's not exactly like that, because the truth is that, as I said, we haven't been managing the company, dLocal, for a few years. So I was a board member, very active in the company, but I wasn't full-time in dLocal. I rejoined more recently. So I did have some spare time. And we saw that opportunity with Datanomic that came from AstroPay. One of the managers over there, he showed me a product that was developed internally, and he asked whether I thought there was an opportunity over there. And I really liked it, and they said, okay, let's turn it into a separate company, and you'll be the CEO of that company, and I will help you and mentor you. So I wasn't full-time in Datanomic either. So back to your question, I'm a firm believer that if you're going to start a company, you need to be all in. You need to be really full life into it. So those other companies, I've mentored those, I've been a board member, I've helped, but not manage. Managing is a full contact job.
So what do you think is going to be? What do you think is going to be the next chapter for you, Sergio?
I really love what I'm doing. I'm quite involved today in dLocal. Again, I have an important role inside the company. I'm not dedicating that much time as I used to. And I love mentoring and helping other people start their own companies and realizing their dreams. So I like to use the parallel. I became a grandfather relatively short time ago. So I like to say that starting a company is like becoming a father or a mother. It's a lot of work, big realization. It's really fulfilling in an incredible way. And mentoring and investing in a company is a bit like being a grandfather. So you're not as involved. You can have many more. It's not practical to have more than, I don't know, two or three kids. Same thing with startups. Being a grandfather, you can have more. Of course, the amount of satisfaction and realization that you get is not the same, but you still feel the same level of pride and so on. So I see myself continuing helping and mentoring other entrepreneurs. I haven't mentioned, but I organized an event in Punta del Este, which is an amazing summertime in Uruguay's east. It's called Punta Tech. It happens every January, and it's a gathering place of different entrepreneurs, investors, and other corporate people. So again, that's an enabler of contacts, of networking, of transactions. And again, those are the type of things that make me feel very proud. Every time I hear that an entrepreneur met with his co-founder or her co-founder or met her investor in Punta Tech, that makes me feel super proud.
That's amazing. Now, if you could go back in time and give that younger Sergio one piece of advice, you know, maybe that younger Sergio that was putting the notice at Oracle to become an entrepreneur, what would be that one piece of advice for launching a company and why, given what you know now?
The most important thing, it's not the industry, it's not the opportunity, it's not the idea. The most important thing is who you're going to do that with. So you need to find people that you really enjoy working with, and that, because, I mean, if you found the wrong opportunity, you can always say correct course, you can raise more money, less money, but you'll spend a lot of time and you'll go through an emotional roller coaster with whomever you do it with. It's super important that you get along well and that you enjoy the time. You'll spend more time with your co-founder than with your spouse or significant other. So I think that's the number one lesson. Do it with the right people.
I love it. So Sergio, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
I get lots of contacts. So first of all, I'm going to apologize in advance if I don't answer, because I need to be very selective. But LinkedIn is the easiest one.
Amazing. Well, easy enough. Well, Sergio, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me. And I do encourage people to come to Punta del Este for Punta Tech. It's a great place.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.